choque en una tragedia.
Apoyamos la reunión que convocaron México y Uruguay, que se va a realizar en Montevideo el 7 de febrero, y vamos a participar de este proceso con mucha actividad, porque la paz de América Latina depende de cómo se salde esta provocación y si podemos frenar la agresión norteamericana contra el pueblo de Venezuela y el presidente Nicolás Maduro.
El rechazo a la política injerencista de Mauricio Macri fue unánime. Y es que en toda la historia de la República Argentina, ningún presidente intervino en asuntos internos de otros países, incluyendo las dictaduras cívico-militares.
Nosotros hemos ayudado, como Estado, con todos los gobiernos, a la solución pacífica de conflictos. No podemos estar tirando nafta al fuego, como hace Donald Trump, como hace Bolsonaro, que son dos psicópatas. Entonces le exigimos a nuestro presidente Mauricio Macri que revea su posición totalmente equivocada, y le pedimos también a la comunidad internacional, que la mayor parte de los pueblos, hoy salió una encuesta interesante en la Argentina, el pueblo argentino quiere la solución a través del diálogo.
Los manifestantes además desmintieron el apoyo del pueblo argentino al autoproclamado presidente Juan Guaidó y rechazaron su accionar por considerarlo ilegítimo, ilegal y violento. Y anunciaron más actividades que garanticen que América Latina continúe siendo zona de paz. Carolina Silvestre, Telesur, Buenos Aires.
Honduras vuelve a figurar en la lista de los países más corruptos del mundo, según Transparencia Internacional. Daniel Sierra reporta desde Tegucigalpa.
En los últimos 3 años, Honduras ha retrocedido en la lucha contra la corrupción y la impunidad. Lo anterior lo revela el índice de percepción de la corrupción elaborado por Transparencia Internacional, en el que el país de las 5 estrellas nuevamente figura como una de las naciones más corruptas del mundo.
Tenemos un régimen, aparte de que violenta derechos ciudadanos, también ha utilizado el Estado para enriquecer pequeños grupos económicos, pequeños grupos políticos. En pocas palabras, Honduras es prácticamente una hacienda que pertenece a pequeños grupitos de poder económico y político y que no dejan despegar el país hacia un proceso de democratización.
El Consejo Nacional Anticorrupción, ente de sociedad civil, ha presentado varias líneas de investigación sobre supuestos actos de corrupción. La más reciente involucra al expresidente Porfirio Lobo Sosa, del partido gobernante.
Los señalados son los presuntos responsables de haber malversado más de 25 millones de lempiras, ya que dichos fondos están destinados para la ejecución de programas sociales y se utilizaron supuestamente para apoyar la seguridad presidencial.
Varios parlamentarios y actores políticos en Honduras han sido acusados de cometer numerosos actos de corrupción, pero ninguno de ellos ha sido condenado. Al contrario, la mayoría termina en libertad.
Líderes sociales insisten en que los operadores de justicia hondureños responden a los intereses de la clase gobernante, favoreciendo a los acusados por corrupción con resoluciones absolutorias.
Todo el engranaje administrativo y legislativo y también el judicial puede estar compuesto por un mismo sistema de organización, que hay una vinculación y todos están unidos.
El índice de percepción de la corrupción utiliza una escala de 0 a 100, donde 0 es altamente corrupto y 100 es muy limpio. Honduras figura con un porcentaje alarmante de 29, razón por la que sectores de sociedad civil deben involucrarse más en la lucha anticorrupción, dicen académicos.
Ningún ciudadano puede estar aislado de lo que pasa en su país ni de lo que pasa en la vida pública. Todos somos responsables también, corresponsables de lo que está pasando en el país.
Juan Orlando Hernández, junto al Partido Nacional, aprobó una ley de secretos oficiales y derogó la ley de transparencia aprobada durante la administración del expresidente Manuel Zelaya, negando así el acceso de la población a la información pública. Daniel Sierra, Hispan TV, Tegucigalpa.
Aquí concluye esta edición del Informativo Pacífica. Agradecemos la colaboración de RTN, de Telesur, de Radio de Naciones Unidas, del Informativo Farco, de Hispan TV y del diario La Jornada. A nombre de Norma Martínez, se despide tu amigo de siempre, Fernando Velázquez. Gracias por acompañarnos.
101 FM.
How's it taste?
It's a delightful taste sensation. Yes.
101 FM.
101 FM.
Good evening, my friends. Afternoon and day. This is our duck here, asking you to help us find a new studio location. $500 to the one that can provide. If you know such a spot, it needs, a bathroom, electricity, ability to connect internet and telephone. Dry would be nice. We all thank you in advance for your support of this truly community-operated pirate radio station. 101.3 FM, freakradio.org. Send us an email with your knowledge. frsc@freakradio.org. We thank you in advance.
And up next on the stream of Free Radio Santa Cruz, it's the February 7th. February 7th edition of Bathrop Spears Broadsides 2019, with a particular focus on, we're going to take snapshots of the most recent ACLU's ceremonial activities, none of them involving homelessness, of course, but what do we expect? As well as some work from Salinas by video journalist Wes White, who's been covering the Salinas sweeps here in Santa Cruz. The sweeps, if they've been happening at all, have been more individualized, low-key, and get to the Ross camp, or at least that's kind of my impression, although we've yet to get really good information on that. And there'll be that and more as we glide into this edition of Bathrop Spears Broadside. So glide with me.
I'm tired of moon songs, of star and of June songs. They simply make me nap. And ditties romantic drive me nearly frantic. I think they're all full of pap. History's making, nations are quaking. Why sing of stars above? For while we are waiting, Father Time's creating new things to be singing of. Sing me a song with social significance. All other tunes are taboo. I want a ditty with heat in it, appealing with feeling and meat in it. Sing me a song with social significance, or you can sing till you're blue. Let meaning shine from every line, or I won't love you.
So there's been lots of talk lately and a number of meetings with City Council members Crone and Glover, Drew Glover, I don't really be sure if it's Glover or Glover. I call him Glover, but I think it's Glover. Drew, anyway. Regarding some proposals to directly address civil rights violations in the homeless community as well as lack of services there. And there are actually five or six particular changes, large changes, that we began to hammer out 2 weeks ago, and this is to Drew's credit. He and Chris Crone and a number of Drew's interns, I think there were up to four or five of them, all sat in the same room with actual homeless, not just activists who are housed like myself, but homeless people, one living in Ross Camp, one living in an RV, to pound out what needed to be immediately put on the agenda. Crone had said before, you may remember this if you listened to the last January City Council meeting, he had expected there to be a homeless, I think he said this at the meeting, or maybe he said it afterward, a homeless item on the agenda, but that was sidelined or shoveled, not sure by whether it was by Martine Watkins, the mayor, who sets the agenda, or by the city manager, Martine Bernal, who has a strong influence in doings around the city council and around the city generally. He is, in fact, the most powerful figure in the city. But in any case, there was nothing on the agenda homeless-wise, and it was Drew's intention and Chris's intention, I think with the assistance of activist, well, that's a little strong, city council member Sandy Brown, to put items on the upcoming February 12th agenda, which is next Tuesday. Now, in order to do that, you have to get the mayor to itemize those agendas the previous Wednesday, which would be, well, it would have been yesterday. That's when that Wednesday was, for the next upcoming February 12th Tuesday city council meeting. Now, this has been a problem in terms of, let's say, the rent control and rent freeze matters, in that the mayor, previous mayor David Terrazas, and the current mayor, Martine Watkins, are no fan of rent control and just eviction protection, and so they have either resisted, ignored, or actually directly blocked attempts to get these items on the agenda. And when they do get on, there are problems from the city attorney, who starts raising Brown Act concerns. The Brown Act says you have to notify the community 72 hours in advance, and you have to have it agendized, and that's not an unfair requirement, except that it gets bent and sort of squished in different ways depending on whose ox is being gored or whose side is being favored. I kept pushing, for example, the so-called progressives on city council, even when they weren't in a majority, when Brown and Crone were only the only two, quote, credentialed progressives on the council during the last council before the new council got cited, to demand an emergency item on the agenda for rent control so that over the Christmas vacation, people would not be getting exorbitant rent raises that would essentially dump them out over the vacation or make them, you know, feel they had to flee. That I couldn't get Brown to do. I couldn't get Crone to do. Or if they did it, they did it deferring to the city attorney and not seeking any kind of independent legal counsel or not pressing the issue. And then in January, we had the spectacle of Justin Cummins voting to delay the rent freeze based upon the fears, which Cynthia Berger shared, by the way. She's one of the activists now working with HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom. And, of course, she's a Santa Cruz Tenants Association person, if not the only Santa Cruz Tenants Association person. Well, actually, that's not really true, but she's the main person there, if you know, the main light, who's concerned that any rent freeze passed by the new city council, the four votes on the new city council, they could pass such a rent freeze and just protection ordinance, would be overturned by an immediate referendum funded by real estate interests, and then two of the council members, Sandy Brown and Chris Crone, recall. That's the great scare that she believes is the likely outcome, or the Movement for Housing Justice believes that, or I don't know, maybe both of them believe it. I don't know if I believe it or not. I know that it's good to keep pressing these issues, I believe, generally, and trying to play smart politics I'm often quite skeptical of. I'm not entirely skeptical. I try to be open to the realistic political implications of things, but I'm also quite aware that people who like to play smart politics often like to play conservative smart politics. And in so doing, They miss opportunities. They sit back and wait for council consensus that never comes. They do the Micah Posner mouse out, as I call it, which is what he was doing on council. And by the way, Micah has become much less Mikey and mousy. He'll still be a Micah no matter what he wants to do. But he was instrumental in trying to help put together a lot of these homeless recommendations that we pounded out in two sessions. I was on the, surprisingly enough, invited to this session to work on ordinance changes, so that it's not that the council is bold enough to actually propose a lot of ordinance changes immediately, but they are asking that there be, that the staff specifically come up with or direct the police department to provide details about how a whole bunch of laws are impacting homeless people, whether they are being either selectively used to target homeless people, or whether, that's kind of hard to show, or whether they have an undue impact on homeless people. That is, whether people with 115 Coral Street transient or homeless addresses get the overwhelming majority of these citations, which are things like trespass, being in a closed area after dark, sleeping in camping van tickets, much less so now that the Boise versus Martin decision has made cities across this western United States, as well as Santa Cruz, a little more wary of using this particular law, because the courts have ruled that unless you've got adequate shelter space for the entire homeless community, that you cannot enforce laws that make it a crime to sleep or rest in public spaces, at least not as a sort of an absolute overriding everywhere and anywhere kind of phenomenon. And that means that they use other laws. And that's the idea, was to go after those other laws. So getting some documentation, some statistics, or as Cynthia Berger has put it at a recent Huff meeting, some data on what exactly is being done by the police on a daily, nightly, weekly, and monthly basis around getting these tickets, giving these tickets, and giving stay-away orders accompanying these tickets, what appears to be a somewhat unique Santa Cruz phenomenon. I have never heard of it being done anywhere else, although it may well be the case, but I've not heard of any other city that has this law, which came out of a David Chiraz's brainstorm or a brain breakdown or dark night of the soul, where he decided that if the library could expel people for a week, a month, and 6 months based upon rules violations, then why couldn't a police officer do just the same thing all around town if and when she or he or the ranger felt like it? Why wait for the courts to find someone guilty? Why wait for someone to go to trial? I mean, hey, just write them a stay-away order. And that is, in fact, what the city council under Terrazas and Lynn Robinson and Pamela Comstock and Cynthia Matthews and Cynthia Chase and Micah Posner, although I think Posner descended on a couple of occasions, but he did help to increase Parks and Rec's power in a number of ways. Unaccountable power, or they can just close bathrooms at will and so forth. Anyway, the pushback against all that was coming through these proposed changes that were slated to be put on the city council agenda this coming Tuesday, and put on the agenda yesterday at the mayor's essentially agenda-making meeting, and then reach the city council, reach the public today or tomorrow when it's announced to us, and then reach the actual city council chambers on Tuesday when it gets discussed and voted on. Well, the mayor has inordinate power, or at least she believes she does, and the city council has not yet taken to challenging this in any direct way. The progressives, the four people progressives, Drew Glover, Chris Crone, Sandy Brown, and Justin Cummins, to say, wait a minute, three members of the council can put an item on the agenda whether you like it or not. I think it's outrageous that members of the public can't put items on the city council agenda and require the council to debate them and vote on them. I think there should be such a process, and that would be an example of more direct democracy. Although, again, it wouldn't be direct because it's only, you're going to have representatives rather than the whole community having a voice through its being able to speak itself as to what it wants. We have so-called representative democracy, as you know, which is representative mostly of the big bucks and the people who have the time and the energy and the interest and the hope and who are able to do things rather than holding down two or three jobs and struggling to pay rents and so forth. Or find a place to park and sleep, or a bush to sleep under, then they can actually spend some time engaging in these more sort of luxurious political activities. Anyway, however, there was an unusual process that I've never seen happen before, where homeless activists and homeless people were included in addressing a number of what I feel have been long-standing grievances. And those grievances included things like parking places for cars and RVs at night, and one hopes also during the day, because that's the problem in Santa Barbara with their parking program. I'm going to be reading a little bit about that in a bit. Things like eliminating or justifying and clarifying the importance of eliminating the sleeping and camping ordinance from the books, even though it has been seriously cut back in police activity, but also the ugly brother ordinances that are being used instead of the sleeping ban, as I mentioned before, trespass, being in a closed place after dark, obstructing the sidewalk, the state ordinance being used, which is 647E, unlawful lodging. It also needs to go, or at least the police department needs to be advised to ignore it or to make it the lowest priority or some such thing. It's a standard ordinance used against protesters and also against homeless people that the city wants to dislodge from wherever they happen to be trying to rest. And all this can be done, I think, with some pretty assured clarity that there's likely to be, provided the Ninth Circuit, the decision remains in force, always questionable given the new Supreme Court majority that we've got at the highest level above the Ninth Circuit. But if, as long as the Boise v. Martin decision remains in force, it may well be that any of these subsidiary copycat substitute will do the same thing but use different wording type ordinances can also be found to be cruel and unusual punishment and a violation of a basic right of a human being to do what she or he has to do at night, and during the day too on occasion, which is sleep, rest, sit, or lie. And there are various ordinances that are used by rangers and police to essentially corral, move along, disappear, impact homeless people in ways that essentially are the will of the nearby merchants and some conservative residents who have no really legitimate excuse for what they're doing other than aesthetically speaking, or their own personal apprehensions are such that they don't want to see raggedy people in their neighborhood, whether it's because they think it discourages tourists or because they think it is something they don't want to have to tell their children about, or they just feel nervous about saying this, or there's more perhaps some substantive concerns that they link homelessness, as has been done through the right-wing Take Back Santa Cruz, Santa Cruz Police Department, Downtown Neighbors, Santa Cruz Neighbors, all these groups that are of this mentality. They link the presence of homeless people with the petty crime and also drug use and drug abuse of a kind which, of course, no one inside a home would ever do. You know, that they, of course, never abuse drugs in those ways. Homeless people are much more visible, and because they're visible, they become easily much more scapegoatable, and that is what happens with them. And they're also, as I said, there are real concerns. Homeless people also don't have a lot of job opportunities, and particularly in a city where, in order to get any kind of housing, you need to, you know, to engage in two or three jobs, and often your wage scale is insufficient even then to keep things floating very well. Because of that, we have a lot of petty crime. We have people, you know, bike theft, and people sell drugs in order to make money, and then people also engage in harm reduction activity. That is to say, it's not quite the right word, self-medication activity. I don't know if it's harm reduction or harm distractions, because you don't want to think about your miserable situation you're in. In any case, as I've said, a lot of laws impact homeless people. They need to be researched, and that was one of the directives that the progressive three council members are going to put on the agenda. You can't have four. That's a violation of the Brown Act, because that means people are making decisions outside the city council chambers, outside the view of the public, which is really kind of a charade anyway, because the public gets more of a kind of token ability to zip in there and squeak for 2 minutes. Thank you, mum's the word, Martine Watkins. I've called her Mincemeat Martine because of her cutbacks on public speaking, not just homeless public speaking, but everybody's public speaking. But still, the idea is it takes four to pass something, and three people can essentially put it on the agenda. But no, not according to Martine Watkins or city manager or the staff. That was apparently blocked. We had thought we had that going, this group of us that sat down and worked out proposals for RV spaces to sleep, for removing signs from certain streets that are violating the Coastal Commission's right to public access to coastal areas, so that you can't kind of do the sneak around approach that Rochelle Noroyan, when she was a councilwoman, tried to do, which is to ban RVs at night. You can't ban them because Coastal Commission says you can. I'm not a fan of large elitist commissions or small elitist commissions that exercise a large power. But in this case, when the power is on behalf of poor people, I relent a little bit and I say, okay, since poor people can't seem to, you know, are often afraid to stand up for themselves or just don't have the time and energy or sustenance to do it, then good. If somebody comes in and helps, that's fine. So there were those several ordinances, or I should say policy changes, that directing the staff to make some changes. There was a proposal that the Parks and Rec Commission, I should say the Parks and Rec Department, will not be able to change bathroom hours and closing hours on property without getting an okay from the city council. I could have that wrong. It could be only bathrooms. We have the problem of the Loudon Nelson bathrooms, which are still closed. We have the problem of the City Hall bathrooms, which are still closed. And as recently as a few days ago, Anna Brooks, the staff member running the City Hall staff, refused to allow a disabled woman with a written legitimate medical excuse to use the bathroom to have access to a bathroom in the center across the street to the library. She said she couldn't get across the street in the time. Luckily, there was another staff member, Susie O'Hara, who I normally have a very unfriendly word toward because of her abusive behavior towards homeless people, not as an individual, but as a bureaucrat running a program and misinforming them about their services and how long they have to actually be in the areas that they were promised. The infamous 60-person boneyard barbed wire campground on River Street that got prematurely shut down in this fall because the it's not a little clear. They claimed it was budget, but then you have these huge amounts of money rolling in. I mean, it's I sigh when I even think of it. In any case, there were problems with such a simple thing as using a bathroom at City Hall by people who had been invited to a meeting with other council members. The council members showed up late, and the staff wouldn't let them in to use the bathroom or to sit down in chairs. And it was it caused me to get pretty cranky. I'll tell you, I may even be playing some of that for free radio. In fact, I think I will. I've described it. That may be enough. In any case, the question of what we did come up with, which were some proposed staff reports that could be essentially given to the mayor to say, look, we don't need the staff to give us staff reports. City council members themselves have created these staff reports, which they have a right to do, and therefore we want the following items on the agenda. We want RV access, a place to park them at night. We need to eliminate signs in certain areas so people can park their RVs in different places in the city where they aren't bothering anybody, and they're not parking there forever. They're parking there for several hours, or they're parking there at night when the spaces aren't being used. There's also stuff to address problems out at the Ross Camp, which is getting very crowded and is prompting some neighborhood concerns. legitimate, illegitimate, but real, whatever they are, in the minds of the neighbors, whether it's Felker Street neighbors or the Tannery neighbors, or bigots passing by who shout nasty things at the campground, or just the people in the campground itself who are, you know, have, according to Alicia Kuhl's counting of the tents, 198 tents as of a few weeks ago, and growing all the time, and of course expanding outside the campground. We need to have other campgrounds. There needs to be a procedure to set up campgrounds. That was being discussed by Brent Adams in some of his Coalition on Homelessness meetings, and he has such a meeting coming up, by the way, for those of you who are interested in checking it out. I think it's at 7 or 7:30 at Loudoun-L Center this coming Monday. And that would be Monday the 11th, the day before the shitty council meeting. They're still the shitty council to me, folks, until they actually start getting off the pot and starting to do what they need to do. Or let's say opening the bathrooms so some other people other than the privileged staff can do the necessary human functions. The bathrooms at City Hall are still closed during the day, during the night, except when there is a council meeting or some official meeting, and the bathrooms at Loudoun Nelson are still locked with codes unless you are a person who is, quote, having a specific meeting at the Loudoun Nelson Center as part of a scheduled event. It's a pretty outrageous shutdown of public services deliberately to go after homeless folks. The excuse is vandalism, but I've recently been told by individuals in the staff there that the real motivation had to do with overuse of paper towels and paper supplies in the bathroom. And I don't know how accurate that is. That was not reflected in the emails. It wasn't certainly stated as the excuse that Izeth Ray closed the bathroom. She's the Duchess of the Loudoun Nelson Center, the person who runs it there under Carol Skurich, who's under Tony Elliott, who should have been doing stuff to reopen it, but has not been as head of Parks and Rec. So there's also the consideration of a declaration of a general either shelter or homelessness emergency. I'm never sure what the exact terminology is. I mean, as far as I know, we've had three shelter emergencies declared at the end of the last millennium, and they were not like for 1 year. They were ongoing shelter emergencies, is what I understood at the time. I could be wrong. One was in 1990, one was in 1995, and one was in 1998. And so it's been done before. But this time, I guess the reason for a shelter emergency is to gain access to both shelter funding and also to allow zoning changes that would allow opening of different shelters. And there's a proposal, as I mentioned before, by Brent Adams and by Steve Plage, different activists, often at odds with each other. Very critical of each other if you hear their public statements about each other, sadly, or perhaps goes with the territory, wanting private organizations to be able to open up campgrounds and other homeless services without elaborate permitting through the city council or the city's agencies, which can be costly, time-consuming, and difficult to do. So that's another item that was going to be on this this block of five or six staff reports and recommendations that that Drew Glover, Chris Crone, and Sandy Brown were going to bring forward. But I learned yesterday in the middle of the Huff meeting, got a phone call from an activist. I'm sure it was a phone call from Micah or from Drew. It said something to the effect that this was being blocked by the mayor, that the mayor and the city manager had advised them that they needed to have had these things worked out by last Thursday, that is, say, 2 weeks before the city council meeting, and that therefore they'd have to postpone it for another 2 weeks before it could go on the council agenda. This, of course, raised my ire, because I've had no particular confidence in this whole council process from the day one, because I've seen the council play these delay games for a very long period of time. Even when the council makes a vote, the staff sabotages it. But this city council, this progressive majority, at least a minority of the progressive majority, Drew Glover, seems to be aware that this is the history of the staff and that there is now a concerted attempt to get around the staff, to adopt independent interns, creating staff reports so you don't have to rely on the staff for the staff reports. You don't have to rely on the Lord High city manager and his Lord High minions like Tina Scholl and Susie O'Hara to get anywhere with this stuff. But you can actually do it through your own volunteers. And Drew has quite an organization with this Project Pollinate and so forth. And he has a lot of people working with him. And that's something he's been doing. And that has been quite impressive. And he's been very accessible by phone in so doing. But the problem now is, can he get these items on the agenda? Well, perhaps he has. The latest word on this is that it isn't just the mayor who makes up the agenda on the Wednesday before the Tuesday City Council meeting, the week before. It is also the mayor and the vice mayor. I think there may be a third person involved, maybe the city manager, I don't know. But the vice mayor is, in this case, Justin Cummins, one of the progressives who got appointed there instead of Cynthia Matthews, thank goodness, perhaps, although he hasn't shown his progressive colors much yet. I'm still waiting, Justin, to see those colors. Wrote him a letter which he hasn't responded to yet, but who knows. Just yesterday or the day before that I wrote him. He sits down with the mayor to make up the agenda, and apparently he was very upset that the mayor did not put these various recommendations on the agenda because the staff reports were ready and it was being done a week in the usual fashion the week before. She claimed that she'd already had a homelessness item on the agenda, that what they would do instead is they would have it come up at city council on the agendaizing section of the council meeting, and it would go on to the next agenda if the council voted to put it on the next agenda. And that did not please, of course, the people who felt that this was more runaround from the city that don't want to see these items on the agenda particularly. Apparently there's been some sort of compromise made. I can't tell you the exact details of it or say if there is such a compromise until I see the agenda, which I have not been given access to. It, I think, has been made, but it's being kept hush-hush until later on Thursday, probably too late for me to discuss it. But I will be back on a Sunday show that I do regularly at 9:30 into the afternoon, and you can hear my analysis then. In any case, that's kind of the update. And so in response, Huff and Conscience in Action, two groups that are concerned with a lot of these issues, particularly bathrooms, particularly Ross Camp services. And we set a date for a Have a Heart protest, a demonstration at the police department on Thursday, Valentine's Day. But then learning that the city council's mayor was cutting off this issue and not allowing it to be brought up at city council in a regular debate and action fashion this Tuesday coming up, we thought, okay, well, let's do our protest at City Hall, the city council. We also decided to shift the protest from the police department because some of our members are a bit more conservative and they don't want to offend the police. They're not entirely clear that the police have been engaging in this bait and switch business of, we're not giving out camping tickets, but we're still going to arrest you for sleeping and move you along and shove you into the Ross camp, even though we aren't providing adequate facilities there. We're not allowing other campgrounds to be established. The city isn't anyway. That hasn't been definitively proved on a case-by-case basis over a large sample, and therefore we don't want to, you know, falsely accuse dear Chief Andy Mills of doing any such thing. I certainly have heard of people have been told to go to the Ross camp, but I've also heard of others who have been left alone. So it's a mixed bag. So instead of going to the police department with a protest on Valentine's Day, Huff and Conscience in Action and perhaps some other groups are going to be going to the City Hall at 7 o'clock or maybe a little before on the 12th and protesting the city council and the staff's refusal to change the existing situation, which in essence they are responsible for not directing the city manager to direct the police chief to stop harassing the majority of homeless people who are outside in camps that are not at the Ross camp. And not producing an unlivable situation at the Ross camp by overcrowding it. So it's right now there's a protest slated for City Hall on the 12th rather than the police department on the 14th. It was going to be at 1:30 on the 14th on Thursday, coming up a week from today. But now it's next Tuesday, right before and during the city council meeting on the 12th, in order to demand action on, not just so much demand action on the items, because Huff, at least, we've taken the position that it's not that we want to have a lot of nice staff members examining items and trying to figure out if the police are they really going after people with all these tickets, or is that just a, you know, some crazy homeless activist's fevered paranoid dream? Are all these homeless people lying about that? You know, are their property not really being taken and being held away from them except for 4 hours a week at the police station if they can get access to it at all? These things are clearly true, and they're going on, but they're not being acknowledged, and instead there's this laborious process that's being required to even accept the reality of this. Well, that's not what Huff feels needs to be done. We are demanding immediate actions now, and that's what the protest is going to be about at City Hall. Immediate access to services for people in RVs and people in campgrounds and people at Ross. That's what needs to be done. Laundry services, shower services, bathroom services, the kinds of things that you need for a civilized, decent society. And that's what we're pushing for and demanding. And who knows? Could that involve, I don't know, occupying a building, occupying city council chambers, sleeping outside in the closed area around City Hall, as was done by the Freedom Sleepers and the Survival Sleepers? Well, come and see. We don't know what's going to happen. You know, maybe the city will come up with some brilliant solutions to this issue that it's ignored for decades and start addressing these issues. That could always happen. It could start snowing. It did in Boulder Creek on Tuesday. At least I saw some cars covered with snow. I never thought I'd see that in February here, but I never can tell. I'm not optimistic. I'm not suggesting it's about to happen. And right now I'm going to let a little music kind of cover this and come and find out. 6:30 on Tuesday the 12th at City Hall.
I started off in Brooklyn. My father gave me a small loan of $1 million. are to go into the dark.
You're fired. Fired.
And that was Noodle Muffin, Morning in America. The video's got even more punch if you want to check it out on YouTube under anti-Trump protest songs. Ummeyer's Band, there were 41 of them, that's number 13. So in a way it's too bad this isn't a visual podcast show, because a lot of the videos are a lot of fun and have a lot of, as I say, a lot of punch. The next video I'm going to play the audio of is Wes White's recent compilation, well, his recent stint in Salinas. So what I'm playing now is called Selective Sweep in Salinas, California, and it was published on February 6th, that was yesterday, on his channel, which is John Doe 13K. That's, you go to YouTube and you put in two words. The first word is John, J-O-H-N. The second word is Doe 13K, capital D-O-E 13K, all one word. That's John Doe 13K. And the way he describes it, the way West describes it, today three people's encampments were selected to be scooped up and hauled away. I didn't get a chance to speak with people directly affected, but did manage to speak with the officers in charge of the operation. Apparently the city will now be targeting one encampment space a day and not allowing anyone to replace that encampment space, thus eliminating everyone from the playing board of Chinatown in a matter of weeks. Chinatown is in sort of an area along Soledad Street in Salinas, near the actual City Hall complex, and also near what's called Dorothy's Place and a series of other social services, including some bathrooms, believe it or not, where people are setting up tents and have been setting up tents for years on the street in the past. They've been driven away after police raids, but then they come back. The police raid has been mainly a sort of a cleaning operation where people are able to camp there most of the time, live there most of the time, where they have no other options to live. And they just get moved away for a period of time where the sidewalk can be hosed down and so forth. The city, West's story continues, have already fenced up all the vacant lots to force people onto sidewalks. And now no alternative but to yell at your caseworker to advocate for you while the system fails itself and blames the victims. And here's his suggestion. Video all police encounters. Ask, am I being detained? If no, then say, I would rather not say anything to you then. Am I free to stay? Will you please leave me alone now? Hopefully they will go. And actually, if you're being detained, you don't have to say anything anyway. I mean, you don't have to say anything, period. That's what we call the Fifth Amendment. You can decline to answer on the grounds it may tend to incriminate you. It doesn't mean it will, but you don't want to take the chance that it might, because you don't know how these fancy lawyers with their recorders and so forth and their myriad of tripwire laws can cook up something to go after you if they want to move you along, regardless of the violation of the constitutional rights that you should have that is actually happening. Ask, am I being detained? If yes, then ask, may I ask what crime I am suspected of committing? Let them tell you. If it is trespassing on lawful camping related, then ask, what public space am I permitted to be in? As per Martin versus Boise, you will not need to harass me. They will not likely have a space to refer you to. Two, demand written advance notice. There is a policy and procedure in place that the city must abide by. This is in Salinas. Posted written notice must be documented. Note the lack of notice if that's what's happening. Three, if they come for your possessions, demand storage containers for all of your possessions. Video how they treat your possessions while accumulating them and storing them. I noticed a gas can going into the garbage. I would imagine a generator may have went with it. Note any damage, but do not argue with them about it. You are gathering evidence for court. Let them do all the talking. You ask questions that will show the level of professionalism and courtesy we've come to expect. Compassionless compassion. And I would say also, this is what I would add to Wes's suggestions, describe what's going on. As it happens, give the names of the people doing it. If you can, get some names of witnesses and so forth. Here's some of the video. The audio portion of the video, Selective Sweep in Salinas, which you can see as well as here if you go to the YouTube website and look for Selective Sweep in Salinas, California.
Yeah, you came. Thank you.
Hello. How's it going?
Pizza.
Not a lot. I'm just wondering, where's the posting at or something? I guess people are worried. People are worried, so only certain campsites are going, or how's it going?
Right, so one of the big problems is the ADA issue with blocking the sidewalk completely. So from Dorothy's to the health center has been a problem while we've been getting complaints. Sidewalk completely blocked.
Okay, do you have a notice posted somewhere?
Right, so Raul received a notice on Monday morning, as well as two other campsites did. And then we're here 40 hours later.
Okay. And so the notice, I guess you have documentation of that somewhere?
Yep.
Okay. All right. If you could email it to me, that'd be great.
Well, no, you're going to have to go through a public records request act. It's just a photograph of Mr. Raul holding the notice in front of his encampment.
Okay. And the same for the other two or three?
Yep.
And so you're only targeting two or three encampments today?
Right. Just the ones that are making a hazard for disabled people to get by.
Yep. So as long as they're, I mean, where are you trying to delineate, or how is that determined, like who was in, who was out?
So just the blocking of the sidewalk. You know the law better than I do. So the law says that if you're transient, right, or homeless, you can store what would be included in a 55-gallon drum, what you could take with you. And so we have the camping ordinance that requires that everything be down by 7 o'clock in the morning, right? So everybody is in violation.
Okay.
Right? So we can only, how do you eat an elephant? Just one bite at a time. So we're just trying to get people to understand what the law is and how we can all work together.
Of course, it is completely crazy that what they're really trying to do is they're giving police the selective power to remove anybody they want when they want it to do so. By simply raising up this, we have this crazy law that we can use against you whenever we feel like it, even though it violates your right to survive as a human being, as a poor person on the streets. But you have to follow the law, don't you? And that, of course, has been the mantra of conservatives in Santa Cruz who cooked up the public safety task force, the city council majority under David Chirazes and Lynn Robinson, Hillary Bryant, and Cynthia Matthews. All of them were using this, must follow the law, as though that were some sort of sacred item, when in fact it becomes a pretext created by the well-to-do to empower the police to act as sort of street sweepers of poor people and to remove them out of sight and to move them out of town in violation of their rights in the Constitution. Now, there's been some pushback from the courts with the Boise v. Martin decision, or Martin v. Boise decision, and they then have to play the kind of semantic games around this. I notice Wes is not asking these cops to specifically show where there's been a blockage, to show the letter, the complaint letter that states specifically that some disabled people have not been able to get past, which frankly I doubt is I suspect is more the pretext than the reason, but it's a way of turning one group against another, or using the rights supposedly secured by Run Group, the right of disabled people to have free access, to get rid of a lot of disabled people in encampments. I mean, it's really kind of it's really perverse what is being done here.
To get to keep the blight down, the health and sanitary issues that are going on down here.
And, of course, the blight for them is the issue, because the homeless people are the blight. And as for the sanitary issues, that has to do with creating a situation where there can be nothing but sanitary issues, because you don't have decent campgrounds, to say nothing of decent housing or decent shelter. And therefore you can suddenly claim, oh, look at all this indecent stuff. Well, we got to get rid of it. But you, of course, are creating it by gentrifying areas so that ordinary people can't live there, and people who have lived there for years have to move out and have no place to go in the area.
You've got to keep it clean. It's got to be. Absolutely, this department will not criminalize sleeping, being homeless. It's just not.
And that, of course, is horseshit. I'm not an expert on Salinas law, but I believe that's Wes White's opinion, too. Anyway, make catch him talking a little bit about that later in the show, and if not now, then possibly on Sunday when I have more time.
Not going to happen. what we have to do is we have to keep it clean and sanitary, and people have to have a good quality of life. When we start to just start to collect stuff, and we have rotted food and things that are going on, at some point we've got to take some personal responsibility, either within your own campsite, or if you're not going to do it, then we have to step in and do something. So absolutely 100% want to work with the homeless population to figure out how to best do this and how to keep things clean. But we got to start somewhere. Can't have the sidewalks blocked where people can't get down to the...
So it's, you know, is it the sidewalk blocking? Is it the nasty, dirty food? Is it sanitary conditions? Is it those irresponsible homeless? One excuse rises after another. But the reality is to get those ugly-looking poor people out of the area, and to do so while looking good for the media and also looking good for the lawyers, because there are always a few lawyers who are willing to step in, not necessarily because they've got big consciences, but because they'd like to get a little money from some lawsuits. But some of them have got consciences too, and they feel upset at seeing this. I've seen those occasional lawyers in that way, and it's always good to see.
Okay. And I guess with the ordinances that are on the books, I mean, you know, I was kind of frowning and grimacing a little bit. Martin versus Boise, how does that constitutional within the Ninth Circuit, how does that...
And that's Wes White, by the way, in case you missed the voice. That's Wes White asking that question.
It all falls within in the Boise decision. The Boise decision says that you cannot criminalize sleeping. However, you need to take everything down by 7 in the morning. It all fits within that.
Well, you know, by taking it down, though, especially in the rain, basically everything is soiled and destroyed.
It's not raining, bud.
Okay, did it rain yesterday? Did it rain this whole last few days?
Stay in the rain, displacing people in the rain, right?
Yeah, okay, well, that's not my question about this at this instance.
That's exactly what you're
saying. My question is more general and broad.
Uh-huh.
And actually, the Boise decision doesn't say you're only allowed to sleep before 7 o'clock, and you have to have all your stuff gone by 7 o'clock. That's what the Salinas Law says. You have to throw it into these, 10-gallon barrels, however big they are, 50-gallon, I don't know how big they are. But that's the local ordinance. But the district-wide ordinance, I should say, ruling by the Ninth Circuit Court, is that you can't create a law that prohibits... as the Salinas Law does, sitting, sleeping, lying, resting after everywhere in the city, even if you allow people to rest before 7 o'clock. Santa Cruz tried that whole approach way back in the 90s, and they still, I don't think they're trying to do it anymore, but it was the basis of a notorious court ruling by Judge Kangaroo Tom Kelly, who, when confronted by activists like Dragonheart Dan Hopkins, as I called him, and shit kicker Sean Alimi, and other activists who slept in front of City Hall for 7.5 or months or longer, demanding that the sleeping ban be lifted in the absence of adequate shelter. They were told, when Kate Wells, the attorney, took the cases to court because they were getting multiple tickets, that Tom Kelly said, they're still guilty because they can sleep during the day, can't they? And that was his answer.
In the general sense, taking stuff down by 7 in the morning, and if it rains, and even still, I mean, people need shelter, you know.
I understand your concerns. However, if you want to deal with that part of it, you got to deal with the city to change how the law is written. The law is written 7 p.m. to 7 a.m.
Yeah, but Martin versus Boise is actually like, you know, actually the judges were sick of seeing the cases. This is the only thing it really comes down to. Just don't bring it in my courtroom anymore. Otherwise, go ahead and do pretty as you please. But, you know, the whole criminalization thing, it was the affront in using it.
I think what Wes isn't saying, but he's trying to get to, is that it's a criminal even if it happens. Criminalization is being done to homeless people even after 7 o'clock, and so what the hell are you doing demanding they move when you have no place to move them to? But he doesn't quite get to that point. At least he hasn't yet.
You know, like I said, food, clothing, shelter. We need shelter. A permanent address, even if it's a piece of dirt. You know, and so if people were, like you said, you want to help work with that. So if people were able to mitigate pee, poo, and trash, and, you know, poo, the same issue of trash, then is that feasible?
Absolutely, 100%.
Okay.
If we can police ourselves, there's no reason for the police to be involved. We are about our community. These are our community members, right? And if we, all of us, those that have a house, those that don't have a house, are good stewards of our community and are willing to help keep the blight down, keep the health and safety hazards down, you're never going to attract the attention of us, ever. We don't want to do that.
Very well.
What we want to do is we want to take this very large community.
Can this guy really believe what he's saying? He sounds very sincere, you know, and it's often the case that some of the most fascistic people truly believe that they have the best motives and they're really being the most reasonable. I am, you know, I'm not on the streets of Salinas. I guess a quick call to Wes White is not out of the question here, except I'm under a time crunch, so I can't really do that now. It's so familiar to me to hear earnest police officers, whether it's Andy Mills or Martinez, one of the vice chiefs, or all kinds of folks, just saying bureaucrats in positions of power, not truly believing what they say or believing what they've been told, but in fact. There's just such a blatant reality is that there's no place for these people to go, and you're forcing them to abandon a lot of their stuff and move when you have no place to move them to. And you're not supposed to do that according to the higher law, the constitutional law. I'd say nothing of morality or just common human decency unless you have a place to do that. I mean, you know, if they were really serious about health and safety standards, they could have some health inspectors in there offering assistance. They could have trash pickups. They could do different things that I'm not aware are happening along Soledad Street in Chinatown in Salinas.
Of things and say the people that are just trying to make by and want good law-abiding homeless people that have fallen on hard times just want a place. We want to keep them safe. We don't want to mess with them. We don't want to, if we can keep it clean, if we can create an environment where everybody gets along, hey, we are 100% behind that.
Of course, you know, it's just so easy for me to respond, and my just offhand reaction is, unless we're ordered to do otherwise. And it depends what our order from the day is for the sergeant, and that's what we're going to do, whether they've been keeping it clean or not. If we're told to do something, we will march in and we will do it. That's the orders. I've not heard of officers ever denying orders from from their superiors to follow the law, because the law is highly dependent upon the perceptions of the police department. It depends upon the decisions of the superiors. It's has very little to do with the actual substance of real health and safety concerns, at least in these Salinas laws, as I've seen them, as they relate to homeless people the last few years.
So, you know, that'd be great if we could open up lots, you know, either in public, because anywhere public is already legal.
That's way above my above it.
Well, but you're spouting pretty good, which is kind of where I'm trying to, you know, hopefully you can bring this back to, you know, your higher ups as well.
Absolutely, but you know how the city is.
Well, I mean, we're creating more problems. I mean, look at one, two, three guys, three officers, city guy, and then Smith and Enright guys.
No,
I mean, look at all the money.
No Smith and Enright guys.
Okay, this is all city.
Right.
Right, because we ran out of funding or something, right, for the year until July.
So you're a taxpayer citizen in this community, correct?
Yes.
You know that we spent $300,000 last year cleaning up Chinatown.
Okay.
And we literally netted zero, right?
We took 400 tons of garbage to the dump. And we literally are in the same exact situation.
Right.
What we have to do as a community is stop throwing good money.
And how much garbage did the trash department take from people in middle-class homes? We don't get any comparative details there. But because the garbage of homeless people or the possessions of homeless people, which are described as garbage, are so visible and they become the basis for the excuse for getting rid of the homeless encampments when there are no options, you have these ridiculous excuses that people give in a straight, bald-faced manner. It's just familiar.
Money after bad ideas, right? So, if we can get down here, and now I'm down here full time. Well, I'm in the city full time on homeless issues.
Okay.
So, if we can start to develop some mutual, not one-sided, mutual respect.
Right.
Well, we can understand, hey, look, bro, we got to keep this clean. We got to not criminalize it. Let's not get to that point. Let's eliminate our garbage. You know what I did the last 2 days, Wes? Mm-hmm. I sat on a tractor and cleaned up Chinatown. A police officer. I got a shovel in my hand, and I dug trash out of the fence and got it all cleaned up. Did you drive down Market Way?
Well, did you know there were two dumpsters in here, and the city told Republic specifically, don't ever take them out of here and don't ever bring them back?
Well, that, you know what the reason
is? So, I mean, we create a problem to solve a problem? No, I mean, is that what you're talking about?
What's the reason behind that?
I would imagine from out of the area, and especially that guy right there, yes.
Business owners were abusing the dumpsters, and we get it.
Right. Well, but how come you don't just get them in trouble? Because the need is still here.
Right. How would you do that, Wes? Come on, man.
Jeez, don't you have video cameras?
Come on, man.
You mean they don't work?
Come on, man.
Really?
Come on, man.
You can catch everybody else, but except for the big guys?
What happened this morning at 8 o'clock?
I don't know.
Where were you? When we're down
you're right. No, I
trash.
Wasn't. I don't
when
know.
We were cleaning up trash. I was cleaning it up. Myself. Humility. I'm not a big bad cop. I'm not a big badass with my cool stuff. No, I'm down here with my boots muddy on the ground with a shovel in my hand cleaning up because this is our community. But it requires all of us.
Appreciate
you,
that, yeah.
It requires me. It requires him. It requires him to be responsible and be good stewards of our community.
And so...
So says the pious guy who goes home to a comfortable home in the suburbs. I don't know. Maybe he's got a mortgage, too, and he's in bad shape. You know, but he looks like he had a shower last night. He's wearing dark glasses. And he's piling away people's mattresses and tarps and throwing them into a truck for disposal. And calling it waste and calling it blight and calling it garbage. That's what the visual shows. You can't see that, of course, because you're just hearing my commentary. Again, go to Selective Sweep in Salinas, California on YouTube, and you'll be able to find it on John Doe 13K on YouTube.
So there were piles and bags, you know, that was kind of the thing, you know, but then the piles are still piles, and if they don't go anywhere, they don't go anywhere. That's why there's a landfill somewhere else.
Are the piles there?
Not right now.
Because I took them out this morning.
Thank you for that. And I'm glad you brought it. So you are offering everybody a storage container first, right?
Absolutely.
And as many storage containers as they need, or just only one?
One per person.
That's pretty minimizing.
Is he offering them a place to put down the storage container to go rest? If not, he's violating Boise versus Martin. And I don't think Wes is mentioning that, probably because Wes is also focused on the city law, which forbids you from doing that during the day. So you can sleep and rest at night, according to the city law, but not during the day. You can't do that. You have a very limited ability to sit down. And I think you can sit down and rest within a limited area. And perhaps I'll get more details on that from Wes to be reminded of that. I think we went through it a couple of a year or two ago when that law was passed. But here's a little more of the Selective Sweep in Salinas.
That's the way it reads, so I'm only a rule follower. Not the same thing. Rule follower.
Right, you know what they call that, following orders.
Okay. Required to.
And, of course, we don't have the name of this cop, which would be helpful. I think you can, if you really do a close-up, you can see he's got a badge, but...
One of the things I always do when I do a lot of audioing, very little videoing, and videoing can be very helpful, and thank you, Wes, for doing that, is I mention the name of the police officer, preferably repeatedly, so that the audience can know who they're dealing with, so that they can get a sense of if they have some further experience with this police officer on other occasions. They can see if police officer's behavior is typical, or maybe it's an exceptional occasion, or maybe someone is being particularly helpful, or the other way.
You're fired by the phone.
And there's really that little last throwaway line that you may not have heard, I'm going to get fired if I don't, is really one of the key issues here. I mean, that becomes the basis for all kinds of abuses historically in this police department and in police departments across the world and across time. The machine has its own imperatives. The machine has its own dictates. The machine has its own laws. And it also has its own pressures. So if you want to play the game, if you want to get along, you better go along.
Stay safe out there, guys.
Thank you.
And that one fucking older cop came through here telling everybody, and we're taking you all down one by one, that one right there.
The assistant chief down there. Can't remember his name.
And he goes, well, we take it down one by one.
So can you show me a notice? He said everybody got a notice.
Nobody got a notice.
But he told you right now you're about to get taken down, right?
So that he said that he was going to do that to everybody.
Okay.
One by one, he said.
Anyway, if it's like that, then he may as well just put up a posting on a pole or something.
But nobody got a notice. That's a lie. No one's ever received nothing.
Well, he said, they said, I asked him about it, and I'm going to have to do a Public Records Act request for it. Evidence from whatever Monday, I guess, 48 hours later. So he said at least three different people. So anybody and everybody who's gotten swept up, I want to talk to them.
Okay.
And
they've been harassing him. He's the only one they've been harassing for 3 days. Hey, Wes. Hey, isn't that?
Hey, Walter, how you been?
They're saying that they gave us a notice that they were going to do this. That's a lie. Nobody got a notice, huh? They just started coming up and harassing people.
Well, I want to talk to somebody that already got swept out, maybe, or Raul when they're done over there.
The way that I feel, Wes, is that they're making him even take everything out of inside of his house, and that they're going to be able to allow Wes to tell us what we can have in there, like our bed.
Right.
But they've been harassing him for 3 days.
So they have talked to him throughout the week now about moving out of the way?
It's the third day.
Okay.
They've been doing that to him for 3 days already.
It's because it's blocking the sidewalk and people can't get on.
I could understand that. But, okay, he removed everything off the sidewalk. So what does the sidewalk have to do with inside his house?
You're right, because it's still public space, and it is pretty well the city's obligation. Yeah. If not here, somewhere else.
Officer just walked by. He was cool. He was out here helping us. He was driving the scooper to pick up garbage yesterday. So he came through here. He took my tin, whatever my little small tin I have there. This is where I stay right now.
Oh gosh.
So, you know.
Yeah. I know. Yeah, so
he was cool, whatever, you know. But how are you gonna go and tell us that they're going to take us out one by one?
Giving personal notification is I think what they're trying to do is double ensure that you know it's coming, right? So then they do their due diligence of notifying. But there's supposed to be written notice out here.
Oh, and another thing, too.
And before we hear that, notice that Wes is... Well, I don't know if he's more skeptical when he talks to this homeless activist. I know her, but I don't remember her name. We met in various meetings in Salinas a couple of years ago, and apparently she lives there. If I'm seeing the same person that I remember seeing then, she's claiming they got no notice. And presumably she was there, and she would know. And I don't think she has any real... interest in lying to Wes, but Wes is being very skeptical of her. And I think this is a kind of a natural unfortunately, I may share this, middle-class people, and Wes and I are middle-class people, tend to have a certain suspicion, apprehension, distance from people who are lower-class people, poor people who are poor. And particularly somebody with a uniform and a badge who has got his sunglasses on, well-spoken, and, you know, the police officer is supposed to help you in times of trouble, the stuff you were all conditioned and brought up to believe in, is a much more credible source, or so it would seem. But in fact, of course, they're a much less credible source because they're defending their illegitimate behavior in these circumstances with a rosy smile and a reassurance that it's all being done according to book and it's all being done according to law. And it's putting aside the whole issue of whether the laws themselves, and that really is the issue, because Boise versus Martin overturned all those laws, or at least two of those laws, and different cities have had with similar laws feel their laws are threatened. The law that says, thou shalt not sleep, thou shalt not camp, even though we have no shelter for you. So even if the laws are themselves overturned, the police are still using them as a basis for claiming that they're acting properly. And it's in their interest to keep making that argument because it justifies what they're doing. And they don't want to... I guess one of the concerns I have here is you can't make a reasonable argument with a police officer on the job, really, often. You can only do that in terms of your argument as a basis for showing someone watching a video later, or a court watching a video later, that you attempted to reason with a police officer and she or he ignored you and continued to destroy, throw away, or improperly move homeless property out of where it was situated, giving them no legal place to go to.
Then they come out here at the end of the month saying they got to meet a quota getting tickets. That does not even exist.
Who said that?
The cops. They come out here every month. They come out here towards, say, between the 25th to the end of the month. Come out, give them fucking tickets left and right. You know? And then two, I found out that they cannot be given tickets at all. Remember you were telling me? They can't.
Right.
You know,
no, not for camping.
Is, you know, they ain't given nobody a notice. It's like they just picked who they wanted. And that's what they've been doing. The ones they picked on the first day was Louise and Connie. Okay, Connie I could understand because the sidewalk, we need the sidewalk.
Well,
but,
I mean...
But what does that sidewalk have to do with the inside?
Apparently now they're telling me you can only get one bin, which doesn't compute to me. I don't think that's the way the law reads, but that's the way they're being briefed and told to tell people. So that concerns me.
But verbal, it's like they tell us, unless we got proof, well, where's their proof that this is legal?
We have to be able to fight against that because they've already put it on the books and that's what they're claiming to. So we have to prove the contrary.
And so you know what I told them? I go, okay, you tell us you don't want us here? I told them, I go, okay, so where's that $1 million that was given to the homeless? Where's that money?
Well, he just mentioned $330,000 or something to do all these cleanups. And I'm like, yeah, that really helps, don't it? It really helps.
Because this officer, the one that just walked by with the sunglasses, he's the one that told us that. That's why he came out here and volunteered to come help us. It's because there's no more money for the streets. They're broke.
Right.
You
right.
Know?
And
but
the dumpster's
yet,
gone,
yes,
too.
But then,
so
yet,
it's like...
but then yet, at the same time, you know, these guys are picking on one person at a time. They've been arresting him for 3 days now. Literally.
Okay. He mentioned something about notice. There's that bulldozer he was talking about earlier. Little scooper.
He was using that yesterday.
Right? So he was all happy about it.
Yeah.
There we go. Now
the
you see
bulldozer has arrived.
You know, I give him props for that, you know?
Right. Hey, at least he came out and helped. That's
him,
a good thing. Absolutely.
I told him. He's cool, you know?
Right on.
Not sure why they're both commending this police guy with sunglasses who we heard earlier driving the bulldozer along, supposedly, what, to help people move their stuff along. I don't know how a bulldozer helps. Bulldozer helps, you know, dump your stuff into a vehicle. I guess I need to view this whole thing a bit more knowledgeably, possibly with Wes White himself interpreting it for me, and maybe I can do that on Sunday. I may give him a call and see if he can help me to put together a more intelligent understanding of what's going on. In the meantime, let's get a little musical relief.
Ladies and gentlemen, it is my pleasure to introduce to you the next president of the United States of America.
Look at you stood up there, up in your tower, you're a billionaire. Reality TV, household name, you're gonna make America great again.
Mr. Number One. Woo! Mr. Number
Hope
One.
Hope you're happy.
Hope you're having fun.
Mr. Number One.
Yeah.
Mr. Number One.
Hope you're having fun.
Mr. Number One.
Man, so kiss that baby, drop that bomb from that plane, cause sure, right, you're gonna make America great again.
Mr. Number One.
Yeah, yeah.
Mr. Number One.
Happy, hope you're having fun.
You're just a number one.
Yeah, yeah.
Mr. Number
Shake
One.
My hand, oh son of a gun.
Mr. Number
you're
One.
You're so vain.
Mr. Number One. Mr. Number One.
And that was Mr. Number One, performed by Carolina May and the 21st Century. Yeah, you know, the anti-Trump stuff. I should apologize for not giving you more substantive stuff. It'd be nice if we had a song about the bogus Russiagate bullshit that's being used instead of substantive arguments against both the Democrats' Trumpist and the Trump's Trumpist policies that are pretty much, well... If you want to talk about the anti-immigration stuff that Obama did, that would be pertinent too. And it really is, if you're really concerned about decriminalizing immigrants and restoring some basic rights and ending the warfare state. But you're not going to get that way by simply jumping on the anti-Trump bandwagon. And here's an editorial from the San Jose Mercury News, February 3rd. What else are police in California trying to hide from the public? The more Californians learn about the misconduct of their police officers, the harder the cops fight to prevent the public from learning more, which raises key questions. What else are police trying to hide? And why are they seeking court orders around the state trying to block release of records about their actions? Full disclosure, no matter where the Santa Cruz police are doing that, it's just they're just not responding to the kinds of requests I've made for information about their use of force, about the racial profiling stats that they don't put down, or I should say the racial stops that they make, and the race of the people they stop, and where their police officers live, whether they live inside or outside the Santa Cruz City area. There's a whole variety of issues I've raised with the police department that they're not being honest about. So they, too, in their own way, are effectively hiding these issues from the public. They are, I think, responding in some, at least small measure, to the requirement of revealing use of force, deadly force, that they have to come clean on with respect to, for example, the Sean Arnold killing. But I've requested to have all the records of the witnesses to the Sean Arnold killing, all the neighbor interviews. I have not received a line from the police department yet. I made that request, I believe, about a week and a half ago. So maybe they got a few days left. But I'm not holding my breath, as they say. The legal fight, the story continues between police and transparency advocates, including this news organization, San Jose Mercury News, is now engaged in at least nine counties involving at least 17 police agencies. Police in these jurisdictions need to stop to do some serious soul searching. Do they want to protect the public, or do they want to protect rogue officers from exposure, or possibly just ordinary officers doing business as usual and want to continue doing business as usual, or perhaps justified by higher officers who like the way business is being done and don't want it exposed to the public? Those are my additions. Unfortunately, police union leaders are choosing the latter course to protect rogue officers from exposure. Californians deserve better. They deserve to know whether the men and women charged with protecting them are fit for the job. It's now up to the courts, probably eventually the state Supreme Court, to determine whether records about years of abusive police behavior are made public. No, police officers inside the agency could expose those records. It's been done by people like Daniel Ellsberg regarding the Pentagon Papers. It's been done by people who, for example, have exposed things through WikiLeaks. It's been done by people exposing a collateral murder abroad by U.S. forces and then going to jail for it, like Chelsea Manning. Or, of course, the famous Edward Snowden, or Julian Assange, who's now in declining health, barricaded into a Ecuadorian embassy in London and likely to be exported from there or extradited from there. This came to a head, the article continues, this year because of a new state disclosure law. Senate Bill 1421, authored by State Senator Nancy Skinner, Democrat of Berkeley, that took effect January 1st. Thus far, most police agencies say they will comply with the new law. In Burlingame, released records revealed police department findings that a cop had offered to help a suspect in exchange for sex. Subsequent reporting by this news organization and KQED prompted San Mateo County District Attorney Steve Wagstaff to reopen a criminal investigation into the officer's behavior. In Rio Vista, documents revealed that an officer put false information in a report to bolster felony charges against a suspect. And another officer, without a warrant, entered the home of a suspect, shoved him against the wall, and put him in a potentially deadly chokehold, then later lied about what happened. Sunshine of this sort of information is essential if we are to have any hope of cleaning up police abuse. But some police unions are fighting hard to block their agencies from releasing records to keep their secret past misconduct by their members. To keep secret past misconduct. For decades, police in California have enjoyed unparalleled insulation from public accountability. The new law still provides them protections from records disclosure that far exceeds those of other government employees in the state. The law requires only release of records pertaining to cops' discharge of firearms, use of major force, sexual assault, and dishonesty, And I would add that's only in the case of sustained complaints for many of those categories. In other words, there has to have been a complaint about those issues, and that complaint about an officer's conduct has to have been sustained by a professional standards unit, an internal unit within the police agency, which has a very low record, at least in Santa Cruz, of sustaining complaints, although we don't really know because they keep those records hidden. But when they weren't hidden, back in the 1990s, we knew that the record of actually complaints that were made was a small percentage of those that were actually, the number that got sustained was much smaller than those made, a small percentage. But even that's too much for some unions, which don't want the public to know about some of the most serious misconduct. The police unions fighting the new law in the Bay Area, that includes seven in Contra Costa cities, have rushed to court to try to block more releases. They argue that disclosing records from past years violates the officer's constitutional right to privacy. The law at the time the incidents occurred prohibited disclosure of the records, so the new law cannot be applied retroactively, they claim. News organizations and civil rights groups counter that the new law had no restriction on the time period for the affected records and was intended, as Skinner has said repeatedly, that's the woman who brought the law into the state legislature, to apply to incidents from the past. Moreover, the prior law contained procedural, not constitutional, protections that the legislature had authority to amend. This legal fight is likely to drag on and has already delayed the release of records in the affected jurisdictions, which raises the next question: whose side are the cops on? Are they at all interested in purging their ranks of bad officers, or are they more concerned with circling the wagons and maintaining a code of silence? And that's an editorial from the Mercury News of February 3rd. What else are police in California trying to hide from the public? So now I'm going to play a bit of an interview after doing a little bit of reading from Santa Barbara's latest struggle by civil rights advocates to overturn the latest attempt to make it criminal to sleep or live in your vehicle. So here's an article from last September from the Santa Barbara Independent, which I read online. Homeless rights advocate sues city. Argument: oversized vehicle ban is discriminatory. For nearly 2 years now, and this is by writer Nick Welch, who I actually knew years ago when I was working down there in Santa Barbara. At least I was familiar with his writing. I didn't know him personally. For nearly 2 years now, longtime homeless rights advocate Peter Marin has been threatening to sue the city of Santa Barbara over an ordinance that bans oversized vehicles from parking on city streets. Late last week, that was in September, Marin and his Committee of Social Justice, or for Social Justice organization, made good on that threat, filing a federal civil rights complaint on behalf of 14 individuals who live in their RVs. Marin has argued that the city's ordinance that bans oversized vehicles, defined as any vehicle bigger than 80 inches wide, 82 inches high, or 25 feet long, was passed in 2016 to provide the city police the legal pretext to chase RV dwellers out of town while maintaining the appearance that they're acting to enhance traffic safety for motorists. When the city council voted to adopt the measure, it did so on the grounds that oversized vehicles blocked sight lines of motorists, cyclists, and pedestrians, thus making the roads more hazardous. Marin and his attorney, Russell Brown, argue that the law is inherently discriminatory because it offers a host of exemptions to many classes of oversized vehicles, such as delivery vans, contractor vans, tour buses, that are not available to people, these exemptions, who happen to live in their RVs. Among the plaintiffs are about five who suffer from chronic disabilities. Some fit stereotypes of being rough around the edges, and so too are their vehicles. During last Friday's press conference in front of City Hall, that's again in September, one of the plaintiffs drove his beat-up RV around De La Guerra Plaza, honking his horn. "I get that I don't want that guy parked in front of my house," noted Brown, "but restrictions that say you can't park anywhere are unreasonable. The Constitution gives all citizens the right to travel wherever they choose," Brown argued, "but the city ordinance effectively bans a class of people from the streets of Santa Barbara." And, of course, that was the argument we used to stop the Coastal Commission's support for, actually to prompt them to block an ordinance passed by the Santa Cruz City Council at the behest of council member, now out of office, Rochelle Narayan, who banned RVs at night from parking in Santa Cruz. We were able to show that that essentially denied them access to the coastal areas and that it was primarily an attack on poor people living in their vehicles. And that we're still fighting that one, and that's actually part of these ordinances that are going to be maybe showing up on the Tuesday agenda at City Hall. That is to say, the right for people to park some places without being harassed under the pretext of the 72-hour law, which you may remember was the basis for a press conference that we held supporting the concerns of Alicia Kuhl and other RV dwellers and people living in their vehicles whose only housing is a vehicle, who claim that they're being harassed by police on the basis of false complaints by neighbors that they've been there for 72 hours when in fact they've just been there for a much shorter period of time, and the police are not telling the false complainers that they're making false complaints and they're going to be themselves held liable for making a false police report. Instead, the police are threatening the RV dwellers and saying, move along, we're taking these RV dwellers, I should say these residents who are complaining about the RV dwellers, at their word. Although that I don't have a lot of clear records as to that specific documentation that they're that a lot of people, but the threatening is happening. Whether people are getting tickets or not, they're being confronted with police officers telling them that they've received a complaint about them parking in front of a house and they seem to have been there. You can only be here for 72 hours and you better move along, that sort of thing. Continuing this story about the Santa Barbara RV law and the challenge that is now going into court. At night, many of the plaintiffs park their RVs in city lots managed by the Safe Parking Program, which we have none in Santa Cruz. Spaces, however, are limited, and that's one of the concerns that Drew Glover and Chris Crone and others will say they want to bring up in the city and actually raise as at least allow city private agencies to establish a safe parking program, or even, I'm not clear if they actually want to fund one by the city, but there needs to be such spaces, obviously. Spaces, however, in Santa Barbara are limited, and the rules of conduct are restrictive. Guests, for example, are not allowed. Oh, sounds like Susie O'Hara's Boneyard River Street campground that she shut down prematurely and in violation of her promises. This rule, Brown argued, violated the constitutional right to free assembly. The rule of not allowing guests in Santa Barbara, or for that matter, not allowing people in the campground. I guess they can do it there. That's one of the advantages of the San Lorenzo campground and the Ross campground is guests can go in. Of course, it's a disadvantage, too, if your stuff gets stolen. So I guess it's a toss-up. Brown grew up in Goleta, that's the lawyer, in Santa Barbara, and attended local public schools. He argued that the law was crafted in the first place to be a neutral-seeming measure that could withstand legal challenge by activists like Marin, who've argued laws explicitly targeting the poor are unconstitutional. Marin and City Hall have, in fact, been playing legal cat-and-mouse games over previous efforts to restrict RV parking in certain neighborhoods for nearly 20 years. While Marin hasn't won such skirmishes, he's proven a stubborn adversary and an effective nuisance. The new ordinance emerged out of those legal battles, but when it was drafted, owners of large Sprinter-style vans, many in the contracting business, came out of the woodwork. The Chamber of Commerce likewise assailed the ordinance, claiming it was anti-business. Exemptions were included to assuage such concerns. Permits could be applied for, but only in parking spots that didn't block the sanctity of the sight lines. Marin and Brown objected that the ordinance has become yet another weapon in a war waged against poor people. First, they complained RV dwellers are given tickets they can't afford to pay, $48 a pop. Once 5 tickets accumulate unpaid, police can have the offending vehicles towed. The cost of towing is $810, plus a $100 per day impound fee and a $160 release fee. I wonder what those fees are in Santa Cruz. By comparison, if anybody knows, please let me know. 423-4833 is my number. And if you want to call in about anything on this program, please do it. 423-4833. By comparison, Brown stated the towing charge on other impound tickets is only $550. compared with $810 plus $100 per day impound fee and $160 release fee. More evidence, he argued, of the ordinance's discriminatory purpose. About five RVs to date have been towed. City Attorney Ariel Caron said the ordinance was drafted with the expectation Marin would file a lawsuit. He deferred comment on the challenge until after he met with the council in closed session to discuss the litigation. I'm not even sure that I've seen the city's reply, even though this lawsuit was filed 6 months ago and may just now be coming up for court challenge or a court discussion. So now what I'm going to do is play for you an interview I had with Peter Marin, actually part of an interview. Part of it will be played today and part of it on Sunday. And here it is. Peter Marin.
Yes, Robert Norris.
How are you doing, sir?
I'm all right.
Well, I'm here at 10. How are you feeling? You feeling like doing an interview?
Yes, we may as well.
Well, good enough. Shall I begin with what you think is on the top of the list, or shall I just start running down stuff I've got?
You begin.
Well, let's see. The most thing I've recently read from you, of course, you did some, passed on some poetry around New Year's, but you also did a poem around the death of Dan Knapp.
Yeah.
And I was looking at the obituary that Nancy McCready, I guess Bob Hansen, or maybe Crystal Freedom did.
Yeah, a nice obituary about the good old days.
Indeed. Anything you want to say about both the good old days and the current wretched days?
Yeah, I ran into a guy on State Street, actually, a couple nights ago in front of the museum where the homeless, again, tend to congregate. And black guy, been homeless for about 30 years, lives on Social Security, and he was left from the old days, and he said to me, as opposed to me saying to him, he said, we don't seem organized anymore. And that's the truth of it. It was a point many years ago. You were here then in Santa Barbara, I remember, in your bathrobe.
Yes.
A strategy you may want to explain to your listeners.
Mm.
Nancy McCready and Bob Hansen actually had started putting together a conversational group of the homeless in the Sunday Park where they had a feeding. And I went to that, as did several other people with homes, and out of that grew an organization called the Homeless Coalition, which was, in fact, astonishingly effective in what it did and tried to do. We established the first shelter here in Santa Barbara long before there were public funds for it, and indeed opposed various egregious laws, got national publicity, embarrassed the city into changing some of its laws, and were perpetually at the city council meetings and county supervisor meetings advocating and actually achieving change of various kinds. It was also organized around an organization called
Legal Defense Center.
Yeah, the Legal Defense Center, run by a guy named Will Hastings, which, if I remember right, was the organization that won homeless people the right to vote by insisting that they could use any location in town as the address required by the law.
Indeed, and in fact, homeless people blocked the freeway at one point I'm not sure whether it was on this issue or on the deaths of homeless people in the mid-80s that this happened, because I wasn't in Santa Barbara at that time.
No, it would have been earlier. With the deaths of homeless people later on, it wasn't so much homeless organizations, but just advocates who organized and showed up at the supervisor meeting insisting on a year-round shelter.
Mm-hmm.
But in actually, at that point, we insisted on the freedom, what we call the freedom warming centers, where in cold weather a shelter was provided to people. But all of that, the earlier version, which was the homeless speaking up for themselves, and the somewhat later version, which was advocates speaking up for the homeless, really has pretty much vanished.
What's the situation been like this winter there for both warming centers, shelters,
And I think a lot of, in those days, homeless did shelter themselves, as they are doing throughout the country, in the main, I think, in spite of, you know, the huge millions being spent, supposedly, on homeless shelter, navigation centers, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, there are two ways to answer your question. One is this. We did, for a long time, have a public shelter here called Casa Esperanza, largely because of neighborhood opposition to its presence and the presence of the homeless. It was eventually shut down by its board of directors, and the building passed on to a group called PATH, P-A-T-H. I'm not quite sure what that stands for, but they were essentially a recovery program begun and centered in Los Angeles that spread its way up here. Very effective, but very hard-nosed. And at the point that PATH came up here, all of the services provided by the shelter disappeared. Now, I want to go over those services because it's important to understand what they were. They didn't just shelter people at night, but they provided a midday meal, a day center where people could go during the day, and just as importantly, bathrooms and laundry facilities so people could clean their belongings and their clothes and stay clean, and also have a place to go to the bathroom without breaking the law by going outside, which is fairly common for homeless people. Now, when PATH came in, they put an end to all those services.
You remember when that was?
Oh, it would be 4 years ago, I think.
Uh-huh.
I'm only estimating. However, there was a sort of low-humming outcry against the loss of those services, and PATH was not originally very sympathetic to the homeless. However, they did hire a guy named Chuck Flax, who is the son of Mimi and Dick Flax, who you may remember. They were Santa Barbara leftist radicals, not particularly concerned with homelessness, but very active in the community. Their son Chuck is concerned about homelessness. He was hired by PATH, and he has done a lot of work, really good work, so that during the winter, PATH will open itself up in bad weather to the homeless, and they have 50 beds available to the homeless, and if you're in their shelter, you can use all their services, and you can stay there all day, so it's not just the night shelter. And that is a new development, and Chuck has been really the best of the local service providers in terms of trying to provide, during bad weather, a place for the homeless to go.
How many nights this winter would you estimate that PATH's been open?
He's open most of the time. And indeed, if you are homeless and you want to go to PATH for 30 days, you can easily apply to be in their program, and they will let you stay there for 30 days and try to get you started on the disability process, try to get you on the housing list. In other words, they are the most efficient service providers we have in town, and you can get off the streets at least for 30 days. And as I said, they're open at the drop of a hat, according to their own lights.
Mm-hmm. Are there storage facilities available here in Santa Cruz? A group called a man named Brent Adams has opened up a day and night storage open to every homeless person in town, where he simply has a situation where he provides free storage. He doesn't get any funding from the city. He's concerned about establishing it as a city program, but they aren't interested, so he's...
No, we do not. We do not have, and I will get to that in the course of this little peroration, but no, we don't have that.
I mention that because when you're talking about PATH, I wondered if an individual wants to go into PATH, do they store his stuff, or does he have to abandon it?
I believe they will store his stuff. I do know that if you're living in a car, they will let you park the car in their parking lot, which is a big deal for people who live in cars.
Yeah, hear you.
Another problem, which I don't think they solve, and which I saw confronted head-on by a wonderful shelter up in, where the hell is it, Northern California. It's in Sacramento, called Loaves and Fishes, which was run, and I think it's still run, by folks who came out of the Cesar Chavez farm worker movement. They provide not only a place to store your stuff, but shelter for animals, which is a very big deal for many homeless people. That is, if they have to go into a program or a shelter and are required to give up their animals, they will not do it. Mm-hmm. And the cost in Santa Barbara for keeping your animal at an animal shelter is prohibitive, right? And I have not been able yet to get the supervisors to allow the homeless, when they need to put their animals into the animal shelter at no cost.
You know, if the census or any other agency has figured out what percentage of the homeless population actually has animals?
No. No. I know women like to have them for protection, right? They make them feel safer when they're out on their own. But I do not know how many people have them. Many people living in cars have animals, that much I know.
Mm-hmm.
That's quite common.
I have to ask this, although, you know, it's a familiar question.
Yes.
Any estimates of the homeless population in Santa Barbara?
You know, the counters say, the only figure I've seen is that there are 1,100 people in need of immediate housing. Now, we're getting sort of off the track, but let me talk to you for a minute about the numbers of homeless people, and then I'll get back to where I was before, because I don't want to lose the track of it.
Okay.
But here's the problem. The housing advocates have counted, they say, the number of people on the streets in need of immediate and supportive housing, and their figure is 1,100. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
I believe that's in Santa Barbara and its region and not the county as a whole, okay, but only the city. However, and this is very interesting, Chuck Flax, who I mentioned to you before, who I think of as a really good man, reported to me with an email that the county schools count up the number of homeless children. And this is an interesting number. The number they use is that we have 10,000 homeless people in the county of Santa Barbara, homeless children. In the county of Santa Barbara. But here's how they count. They will count children belonging to a family that lacks its own housing unit. So that will mean people with staying in other people, people with on someone else's couch. Usually, I think, to a large extent, immigrant families who bunk in with other families or with relatives. The reason I mention that is, if you take the figure of 10,000 homeless kids and try to figure out how many homeless families we have in the county, what you see is, in terms of the need for housing, there's this immense backlog of people who need housing that they do not have. You understand?
Yeah, very well. Santa Cruz is similar.
Right. So when you talk about who needs housing or how many homeless people there are, it depends how you count, all right?
Mm-hmm.
So maybe there are 1,100 people on the street in need of immediate housing, but if you're serious about housing people, there are thousands of people who need to be housed and require affordable housing who don't have it.
Now, Santa Cruz has been called the most expensive county, perhaps second to San Francisco in the country, for housing. How does Santa Barbara stack up?
We're high up there, too. We're one of the most expensive areas in the country.
And you mentioned in past conversations the destruction of single-room occupancies as solutions for people who are low-income or homeless, or temporary solutions, and the destruction of that. How have rents been looking in the last 4 years in Santa Barbara? Do you have a sense on...
Yeah, they rise up. So you're looking at, well, we don't have SROs anymore, right? Those are all gone. And they used to be $500 a month when you and I were in town together, right? Now, there's an important part to that, but the studio apartments and one-bedroom apartments, I would say, are a minimum of $1,000 or $1,200 a month. Okay. Now, the important thing about that is that prices them out of the reach of people on disability. Right? And this is something to pay attention to, though it's forgotten by most politicians. The payments for disability, which are somewhere between $800 and $900 a month for most people, have really not budged in the last 20 years. And that means that people who live on disability are totally unable on their own to find any kind of housing. Right? Now, that development has to do both with the cost of housing and the fact that disability has not moved appropriately to provide people with a living minimum source of income.
Any sense of disability organizing or tenant organizing in Santa Barbara?
No. No. Periodically, the idea of rent control comes up, and it's been on the ballot once or twice, but it's always been roundly defeated, even though we are a liberal and democratic community, supposedly.
Are you a tenant majority community?
Actually, we probably are, but you know, the argument about state control, the bad effects of rent control, et cetera, usually win the day. Now, before we get in that direction, let me go back to one other thing.
Mm-hmm.
And those are Section 8 vouchers for housing, right? As you know, these are provided by the federal government and to some extent by the state, and they augment the amount people are able to pay for housing. Mm-hmm. However, HUD has never been generous enough with these vouchers or financing for these vouchers, and it's gotten even worse under Trump. So that in our town, you will probably know the figures for your town. In our town, the wait for a Section 8 voucher can run 6 to 8 years.
Mm-hmm.
So we do have a little bit of affordable housing, not very much, and we have these the attempts to subsidize the amount people pay for rent. But that is so grudging in terms of the total amount available that there's this very long wait for vouchers, and also most landlords won't accept vouchers, which makes it hard to use a voucher even when you get hold of it, because most landlords would prefer to rent to people with more money.
There's a lot of babble at the state level and even locally about, you know, pathways to housing, housing first, affordable housing, yak, yak, yak. And there's been some large grants, supposedly,
yes,
from the state coming to here. But, of course, ironically, in Santa Cruz, winter shelter has been cut back.
Exactly. That's the point I was going to make to you. At this point in time, and I've tried to deal with them, I just had a meeting. I've been making so much noise about shelter that people who work with United Way, whose main interest in housing the poor, called a meeting that I could attend and so I could discuss with other people the need for shelter. What I found was their interest in theoretically housing people was so pronounced they weren't interested in any interim solution like shelter for people who are presently on the streets waiting for housing.
Mm-hmm.
What's happened here is that when the feds decided to put their money into housing, almost every organization that deals with the homeless became a housing organization.
Yep.
And they ceased to concern themselves with the day-to-day problems of people on the street. Right? So the organization I run, and which I've run for a long time, called the Committee for Social Justice, is about the only one that deals with emergency situations. And there's no money here for people who get in trouble at the end of the month because their disability checks have run out. There's no movement here for temporary shelter. In point of fact, sad to say, about a year ago, there appeared in our local newspaper a letter from several of the people who had run Casa Esperanza, that is the day-to-day homeless shelter.
Mm-hmm.
And in that letter, they suggested that shelter actually enabled homelessness and therefore was a bad thing.
Yeah, yeah. I heard that
right?
One.
Yeah, but that's scary. I mean, that's really hard to believe. believe that people who care about the homeless are writing that we ought not to have a shelter because it encourages people to stay on the street.
Isn't this based upon the desire to coax funding for their projects based upon their theory that they can't get it for shelter, so they're going to try to get it for so-called pathways to housing that doesn't exist?
Yeah, that's part of it, but I've actually run into several supposed advocates for the homeless who believe that that any kind of help for the homeless enables them to stay homeless.
Did they say why, if it was true, their views had changed?
They haven't said why. However, you must remember that underneath everything, ours is a very puritanical nation. Right?
Yeah.
With this great undertow of belief that, which in some ways is good, you know, that if you want to make something of yourself, you can, and if you haven't made something of yourself, it must be your own fault.
Yeah.
It must be a choice, right? Now, for anybody who's dealt with homeless people to really believe that is almost beyond belief, but there are people who still believe that.
Mm-hmm.
And how can that be? If you live on disability, the state's already decided that you can't function and work, right? And they're pretty strict with that designation. So if they say you're disabled, you really are disabled, you got $800 in your pocket. How the... Excuse me, I was about to use the wrong kind of language.
Watch your fucking language.
Yeah, thank you. How the fuck are you supposed to take care of yourself on $800 a month? It's beyond belief, right?
Mm-hmm.
Not only that, we know, you and I know who's homeless, people whose lives have been screwed up one way or another. There may be a few freeloaders in the sense that you and I both know there's guys who like to live on the margins of society and go from place to place as they can and try to make do. They're sort of outdoors people, but they live in the city. And they try to live on their own wits, right? I get that.
Mm-hmm.
There's also alcoholics and people strung out on drugs. You know that too. But the notion that we're going to make everybody better by not helping them is the one that beggars belief.
Plus, it's so disproportionate if you consider the situation with bankster fraud and foreign wars. I mean, it's huge.
I understand.
Yeah, I mean...
I understand this, right? And
mm-hmm.
and the...
Yeah.
I mean, look, when people come to me for help, I don't make them fill out forms, and I ask them what the story is. And half the time, I know they're lying to me, but we help them anyway, right? We help them anyway because they need help.
And that's about it for Bathrop Spears Broadsides tonight. Back again on Sunday with part two of Peter Maron's critique and my questioning of him around the Santa Barbara scene. So don't forget to tune in for that one. That's going to be sometime between 9:30 and early afternoon on Sunday. Also, should be giving you the latest update on what's going on at the shitty council, at least what the mayor's agenda looks like, which should be of interest. And there'll be a lot of other little tidbits, snips, snatches, and probably the inevitable flashback. So join me then, and let's go out on this music, shall we?
His appointees are incompetent. His rhetoric is ridiculous and ludicrous. He's a vengeful, petty, spiteful man. And he's so vain he has a dying spray tan. Impeach him. Now he's got the nuclear codes. The nuclear codes, this ain't a joke anymore. Impeach him. The Donald is a dangerous man. Let's use the Constitution to take a stand. Impeach him. Article 2, Section 4. The House brings it to the floor. Then the Senate lays it down. Next thing you know, they settle the score. Impeach him. Go to house.gov, spread the love.
Go to house.gov, spread the love.
Go to house.gov, spread the love.
1, 2, 3,
and feature. Save the Republic. Save democracy. Save humanity. Save yourself.
Dear listeners, all of us here at Free Radio Santa Cruz announce with great sadness that our dear and beloved Uncle Dennis has passed away, surrounded by the love of his family. You may remember him for his truly great show, From the Cream to the Dregs, or for the so much needed echo news about the state of our planet like Earth First Update. Uncle Dennis was one of the founders of Free Radio Santa Cruz. He dedicated much of his life to its survival, keeping the ship going despite all the difficulties, from the recovery after the 2004 raid and the consequent confiscation of gear, to the frequent site change for transmitter and antenna. We largely owe to Uncle Dennis the nearly uninterrupted broadcast for these couple decades. We all will remember him as a true guide for our collective and a wonderful, generous companion of many adventures. He made many years of Free Radio Santa Cruz possible, and we are so grateful for his dedication and so saddened by his passing. Rest in peace, dear Uncle Dennis, great show host, friend, leader, one amazing pirate of the air.
Such a lonely boy.